No New England states will lose congressional seats following the release of census data earlier this week. Now, we may not have been waiting with bated breath for that news here in Massachusetts, but they were in Rhode Island, where one of only two congressional seats could have been on the chopping block. Actually, it turns out there's a lot at stake when a census count comes out, and we're going to dive into that today and show how it matters. Let's start in Rhode Island. Here to discuss is Ted Nisi, politics and business editor at WPRI-TV in Rhode Island. Ted, welcome to Radio Boston.
Isiana, great to be here.
So great to have you. I think many people would, you know, think, boring census, but there was real drama here for Rhode Island, right?
Yeah, I mean, just to put it in perspective for you, Tiziana, Rhode Island has had at least two seats in the U.S. House of Representatives since 1793, when George Washington was president. So, you know, it would have been a big deal for the Rhode Island to go down to one person in the whole House, joining small states like Vermont and Montana and Montana's getting a second one now, too. And so, you know, I think there was a pride element at stake. And then, of course, there was the more serious elements of, you know, how much voice the state has in Washington, the amount of federal money that's tied to an accurate census count. But definitely, I think the headline people are watching most closely was, would Rhode Island have one seat instead of two going forward?
And Ted, people kind of thought you would, right? That was sort of the conventional wisdom, was that you were going to lose the seat, right?
Everyone did. I mean, you know, the incumbent congressman David Cicilline and Jim Langevin would say, oh, we think we might keep the seat. But frankly, I myself, when I interviewed them, would say, come on, all the experts tell us it's going away. They were right, which they've already reminded me. They were right and I was wrong. But, you know, everyone was running the numbers off of the estimates that the Census Bureau puts together between actual census counts. So they do surveys in the years between the ones every 2010, 2020, et cetera. And Rhode Island looked like it wasn't really growing. And so everyone said, look, if your population's not going up and other states are growing faster, it's just not going to be in the cards for Rhode Island to still have two seats. Rhode Island might be close, but you'd probably fall underneath. So people were shocked. I think most people down here when the list came out and Rhode Island not only didn't lose a seat, but wasn't even the one closest to losing a seat. Rhode Island was a couple up on the list from losing a seat. So just a classic thing where the actual information when it finally came out showed a very different reality than we thought was down here.
So my understanding is that there was a real push to make sure that the census count was accurate down there, that people responded. You had political leaders, state government, mayors, nonprofits all working on this. Is that right? And sort of what went into that coordinated effort?
Yeah, there was a huge effort down here, Tiziana, and I think you're seeing as you look across the country that there seems to be a real divide between the census results for states that invested heavily in outreach and counting as many people as they could find, and states that sort of shrugged and didn't put money into it. So in Rhode Island, a complete count committee was created, involved, you know, elected officials, of course, and state officials, but also local elected officials, mayors, city councilors, community organizations, getting down to the grassroots. And there was also money behind it, $1.5 million between taxpayer dollars that were put in, matched by foundations. And those efforts seem to have really made a difference in the hard-to-count communities. There was a lot of concern about the urban core in Rhode Island around Greater Providence, Central Falls, which is a majority Latino community, that those folks would be harder to find. There was concern after the last census that Central Falls in particular had been undercounted. But it's work, you know, between the concerns about the census people had with the debate over the citizenship question and just the fact that, you know, not for everyone a priority. People are busy. They have other things going on. And there was a pandemic. It seems to me that all that work and the money really mattered because it's clearly not baked in the cake, as you see when you look at states like Arizona, that just because people are living in your state, they were going to get counted.
All right, so let's talk about the politics for a minute. Rhode Island has two sitting congressmen, David Cicilline, as you mentioned, and Jim Langevin. If the state had lost a seat, what, you know, were people lining up? Or was it going to be a head-to-head in the next general? How did that play out, and how will it play out now? Will there be new challengers to the two of them, or are they a lock since their seats are a lock?
Yeah, Tiziana, well, for a political junkies like myself, I admit, and others, that was kind of the fascinating question, right? Rhode Island, like Massachusetts, is basically all Democratic in the leadership level. You know, just about every office higher than mayor is held by a Democrat. So, you know, there isn't usually a lot of competition once an incumbent gets a seat and is safe. And so this was an unusual scenario. One of the two incumbents, Cicilline's, held the first district seat on the coastal side of Rhode Island since 2010. Jim Langevin's held the western seat in Rhode Island since 2001. So these two have been around a long time. And so the idea that they'd run against each other, never seen in a primary next year if there was one seat, never seemed like it was really going to happen, I would say. It just seemed like something would be worked out, even if it was just sort of tacit. And frankly, by the time of this week, a lot of people thought Jim Langevin was kind of going to be elbowed out by Cicilline, because Cicilline raised a lot more money in the first part of this year. He's higher up in leadership down in Washington. He's more aligned with progressives on the issues. So I think particularly for Jim Langevin, he really dodged a difficult situation here, because it wasn't clear what he was going to do. Would he go into the primary? Would he run for governor or something next year? So there was a lot of potential domino effects that aren't happening now because of the keeping the two seats.
And had there been worry about losing the seniority in, you know, Cicilline is chair of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Antitrust. So, I mean, that's an important role. He was in the impeachment team. Was there worry about losing senior place as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Jim Langevin is one of the is higher up in seniority after 20 years in the House on the Democratic side. He's high up on the House Armed Services Committee, which plays an important role in policies that are important around, like, the submarines, which is a big job issue in Rhode Island because of Electric Boat, et cetera. And Cicilline, as you say, has a very high profile now. And so that's part of why I think people thought Cicilline was more likely to keep the one seat if it had gone that way. But yeah, you know, we can talk, you know, the campaign politics insider stuff is fascinating, I admit, and I was covering that. But there were real implications for, also, as you alluded to in the intro, Tiziana, like, the representation for New England as a whole. You know, having, you know, one fewer person representing Southern New England, and that seat being potentially in a place like Montana, Arizona, inevitably would dilute all the regional issues like offshore wind and coastal issues, all of that.
All right. So in the next batch of data from the Census Bureau, so it kind of comes out in tranches. The next will include census tract level data. Are you watching for anything particular there?
Absolutely. You know, shifts within the state, just like I'm watching in Massachusetts, where I cover Congressman Auchincloss and Congressman Keating down here on the South Coast. You know, are we seeing that more people are living in the urban core? Have we seen movement? Last time when the census came, we saw a lot of people going down into some of the southern parts of Rhode Island, the towns closer to the Connecticut border. You know, where are people living? It's always fascinating as a reporter, because you have what you think is going on when you look at the kind of read the tea leaves and look at what's happening in neighborhoods and what you're hearing. But that census tract data really tells us a lot of stories, and then has a lot of political implications about the state legislature. You know, with two seats, inevitably, there's not too many things you can do with drawing the maps for Congress. But for the General Assembly, where there's a lot of tension between the more conservative and progressive Democrats in Rhode Island, could have big implications.
All right. Ted Nisi, politics and business editor at WPRI-TV in Rhode Island. Ted, that was fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
All right, so that was Rhode Island. So let's dive now into the picture here in Massachusetts and in the rest of New England. For that, we have Evan Horowitz, who is executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. Evan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Tiziana, it is great to be here with you.
Great to have you. So there was some nail biting in Rhode Island. Was there any for Massachusetts or the rest of New England?
I mean, no, there was no nail biting on the question of whether we would pick up or lose seats, but there will be a lot of nail biting about whether there'll be shifting districts and whether particular individuals will end up losing seats looking ahead.
Yeah, so actually, I want to dive right into that since you brought it up. The results of these numbers do lead to drawing new districts, which will have to happen here because some parts of the state are growing faster than the others. Here's a little bit of sound from Secretary of State Bill Galvin.
Once we get the figures to redraw the precincts and to make sure that these districts are even in population, this process will unfold probably in the August, September, and October period.
That is not long from now. Do you expect any radical changes? I'm thinking, for example, changes in East Massachusetts representation versus Western Massachusetts.
I think it's possible. I mean, Secretary Galvin makes it sound like a technocratic process in that clip. It's a political process. There isn't a formula that you just plug numbers in. It's a fight over where you draw lines and what the basic principles should be for how you draw lines. Are you trying to create districts with an eye toward racial equity? Are you trying to create districts with an eye toward sort of mathematical notions of compactness or supposed to look good and not look too much like a gerrymander? Are you worried too much about geographic representation? So, you know, you have to settle on principles before you can start drawing lines. And there's some fighting to be done around what the principles should be.
I also want to point out, we weren't really nail-biting, as you said, but maybe we should have been. I mean, it's not that unusual for Massachusetts to lose seats during these count seven, right? As I understand it, we had 12 seats less than 50 years ago, and we're down to 9 now.
Yeah, we lost a seat last time. The last time we picked up seats was 1910. It's been a long time since Massachusetts' population grew fast enough to get us a larger congressional delegation. So in the long term, the trend is definitely downward. Although, you know, there was one of the things we learned this week is that the population of Massachusetts held up better than expected. It was pretty robust. And that's a good sign, I think, for the health of the state, the desirability of, you know, this little picturesque part of America.
All right. I want to talk about that a little bit. Straight up, how certain are you that the numbers are right? And I want to be specific about my question. It has been widely reported, including by NPR, that the Trump administration tried to disrupt the counting process. An example is the push to remove those who are undocumented from the count, as Ted Nisi pointed out in the first half of this conversation. The count also took place during a pandemic, and not just then, but in the early stages. People were moving around, maybe heading home for lockdown or relocating to someplace safer, and afraid of spread. And we are talking about a data collection process that is door to door in the middle of that. Is there confidence that that noise is accounted for in these numbers and that they are accurate?
This is a really, really tricky question. For all the reasons you lay out, last year was a pretty terrible year in which to undertake a census. And even in the best of circumstances, there's a long history of undercounting populations, particularly vulnerable populations, communities of color in census. So the first answer is these things are always wrong, right? It's a question of how wrong are they? What is the margin of error? How many people are you missing? And how sort of even is the distribution of the people that you're missing? Comparing the results we got this week from the decennial census with the estimates does suggest that the errors are very small. Whatever we're talking about, we didn't see large deviations, particularly not in New England. There are other states, Nevada came up before, as a place where the true population count, that is the decennial population count, really did deviate a lot from the prior estimates. And that raises some questions that, you know, the Census Bureau says they've looked into, and I hope journalists also look into.
So to be super clear, in between these once every 10 years counts, there are estimates, well-informed estimates that are done. And one of the things that we do to assess the quality of the data during the 10-year count is see how close it is to the interim estimates that were done. Is that correct?
Yeah, so, and the interim estimates are done in a different way. So, I mean, it's kind of cool to think about how you do this. So it's kind of cool for wonkish people like me. So every 10 years you do a count.
Me too.
But then in between, what you can do is say, well, how many births were there and how many deaths were there and how many people moved in each state? And, you know, the government has these numbers. So you can then track over time, well, the population we think should be this because there were this many deaths and this many births and this many movements, whether it's across state lines or across national lines. And so you can keep a kind of running tally. And then when you count again 10 years later, you can check your running tally. And that's one way that they do it.
Okay, so let's stay with this for a minute. Two things. First, you said we actually did have some population growth. Where's that coming from? Are our gateway cities growing? Are we more of an immigration gateway than we were in the past? Is it business and employment? Where's that growth coming from?
So because of the running counts, this is something that's been known, although it was really kind of solidified in this week's information. And remember, we're talking about kind of growth over 10 years. So think about what the 2010s were like. It's hard to remember because the pandemic has created such a kind of hole in what U.S. history looks like. But this was a time of tremendous sort of popularity of suburbs and especially in kind of university towns and university areas. And that meant big growth in parts of Massachusetts, we being a higher ed hub. This attracts businesses, it attracts people. It's also why you see kind of differential population growth in eastern Massachusetts compared to western Massachusetts. Now, one thing to think about moving forward, and this is pandemic related, is that you could very easily see a shift away from this. That is,
yeah, I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, I mean, if it's kind of suburbs and high-tech jobs or high-skill jobs that are really attracting people to Massachusetts or have been for the last 10 years, it could easily be remote work in farther afield places that are attracting people in the next 10 years. And that could be Western Mass or it could be other parts of New England. So I think the challenge of maintaining the sort of desirability of the state is going to change as the economic landscape changes and remote work becomes sort of more appealing option, even for high, or maybe especially for high-skilled workers who were previously drawn to the kind of high-skill, high-education hubs of Eastern Mass.
So interesting. So we actually could have been capturing the tail of a previous phenomenon here in New England with this count and missing the beginning of a new one.
Oh, I think for sure. In fact, the way this count took place, it's all as of April 1st. That is, everything we learn in the 2020 census is as of April 1st. And that's actually before a lot of the demographic changes of the count. I mean, the tragic one is it doesn't count the tremendous loss of life in the United States over the last year. It's just not reflected in this because it's all as of April 1st. So I think that is a good way to think about it. This is the last kind of pre-pandemic American census.
All right, last question to you is the same one that I asked Ted Nisi from Rhode Island. Next batch of data comes out. It's got census tract level information. What are you looking for?
Well, I'm looking at the political fight ahead because I think once that tract information comes out, that's when people start trying to figure out what the map's going to look like and what the, and I want to, so the, one of the tempting things is to ask, well, will our current congressional representatives keep their seats? And I think, you know, that's an interesting kind of question for journalists, but in some ways it's like not the important question because the point of this is not to help a few people who have good jobs keep their jobs. The point of this is to have a representative set of people go to Washington. And if the underlying demographics have changed, then maybe the representative sent should be different and we should be thinking about sending different people.
All right. That is Evan Horowitz, Executive Director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. Thanks for geeking out with us, Evan.
Oh, you know I love it, Tiziana.